Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, thank you for tuning in to the Shame-Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet, your host, and I think we got Paul on the line. Are you there, Paul?
Yeah, hi, Veronica. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's beautiful weather up here in the Tahoe area, huh?
Yeah.
So, I understand you got a few questions for me. I don't know, should I be nervous?
Yeah, you better be nervous. Yeah,
I'm nervous. Right. Are you gonna put me through it, huh?
you know better than that. Listen, I read your book, The Secret. Wait a minute, Sex Secrets of Escorts. That's it. I got it.
That's the one.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah,
well,
you know.
Thank
and,
you.
And I thought now that you're,
about it?
If you're so available online, you know, with this radio program to answer questions about your book, I thought maybe I'd call in and see if I could get even more information out of you.
Absolutely. What can I tell you?
Okay.
You
well,
know, this is the
first,
adult channel, so you don't have to censor yourself. You can ask me anything you want, and I can answer it.
Okay. Well, the first thing, I wonder if you intended this, but this is my impression as I was reading it, the point of view. It was written, it seemed to be written, you know, as one woman talking to other women about how to please men. But I got a sense as I read it that I was like eavesdropping on a conversation, or I was overhearing something that maybe I shouldn't be reading or something. I mean, it was just a funny, but a very titillating type feeling.
Oh, I like that. I think that's just an old habit, Paul. I think it's the old habit of titillating people for years for money.
You know how to titillate, all right.
It just comes naturally.
Although I think you planned a few of those things, too.
Well, you know, most of the stuff I actually planned was trying to get around the publishers and editor who were trying to turn this into just another boring sex manual. And I was dead set that I wanted to talk about the things I had learned about male culture and men in general. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, some really pertinent women's issues, like, you know, body image. And a lot of women, you know, have actually had abusive experiences with sex. So it's like the idea of writing a book that didn't address those things to me was just so unacceptable. But I really had to work hard to bury those things so that they didn't take them out.
I think you did a good job. I think most of your point got across. I wanted to ask you, on page, I'll refer to some of the pages where I'm getting this information simply because I have it in my notes and nothing else. But on 4 and 5, you have a fascinating list of men by virtue of their careers. You know, the architects, the CEOs, and it raised a question in my mind, which is beyond the scope of the book. You don't address this because it's not relevant, but I was just curious. Oh, when you deal with men from different careers, are there any commonalities or contrasts in their sexual preferences? For example, do the plumbers and farmers have different sexual preferences than professors or architects? Or is there some sort of a genetic archetypal universal male that everything applies to all of them?
You know, I have to say, most of it really broke down by demographics. So I found that men's sexual preferences and behaviors tended to travel with their educational level, their country of origin, their professional identity, So the job that they held had a huge impact on the kind of people that they were. Men are very identified with their jobs, their professions. So, I found quite a few things were predictable. Now, obviously, everybody's an individual, and whatever I say about doctors or lawyers or CEOs is, you know, there's going to be one out there or probably several who don't conform to that. But most of it you can pretty well bet on.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So, in other words, like blue-collar guys would have different preferences than, say, the white-collar guys.
Absolutely. And a lot of that boiled down to the vast majority of the blue-collar guys are taking orders from somebody else. So, you know, they're working for somebody else. And so when they come in, their expectation is, I've worked hard for this money. I saved a long time so I could come to see your expensive butt. And I want to see it all. I want to do all the positions in the book. And I want to make sure I get as much bang for my buck as possible, pun intended, right?
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah. So it's a different mentality, and also there is kind of like this, I would say, McDonald's, you know, culture, which is have it your way.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
and it's just like, well, I'm paying for it, so I want it my way.
And then I think, if I understood correctly, if I wasn't reading between the lines, but the CEOs, these upper society guys tend to want to do these the role reversal or
they are so tired of barking out orders they could just scream, and most of them want to be tied up and spanked. They want to be told what to do.
That's funny.
And keep in mind, if they have a lot of disposable income, if we're talking about somebody who's in a high income bracket, so that they're worth either millions or billions. Their outlook is different. It's not McDonald's. It's, you know, we're going to the five-star restaurant, so what does your chef recommend, right? And it's also like, my nanny is raising my kids, and my interior decorator told me what my study was going to look like. They're much more interested in paying a professional to take them on a guided tour and take over for them so that they can have some time off.
Yeah.
So it is very definitely a different mentality. And it's interesting because I started off working with, actually with the computer nerds. Now, the computer nerds were kind of like, I can't believe I'm in a room with a naked woman and I have no idea what to do.
So, that's why they're computer nerds.
Yeah, I think I'll just sit here and wait for her to tell me what to do because I'm scared to death. And then it was interesting with lawyers. Oftentimes, it seemed like I'd ask them, "Well, what do you do for a living?" And they go, "Ah, same thing you do."
Oh, really? Oh.
I loved lawyers. I always had good experiences with them. They never quibbled about the price. They never tried to get more for their money. I mean, they weren't looking for bargains. And at the same time, they just had a lot more respect for my profession than some other people.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. So I never did get the lawyer jokes, and I always go, why are people so down on lawyers? I think they're excellent clients.
They treated you right.
they certainly did. Now I got to tell you, you know who were the worst were the doctors.
Oh, why is that? Do you think?
Well, a lot of ego there, you know. A lot of ego. You try to start talking about condoms with a doctor, and it's like, I've been up to my elbows in blood today. I'm not worried about a little, you know, vaginal secretions. So, and I'm like, well, how do I get you to use a condom, motherfucker? No.
Hey, listen, yeah. There's a section in your book that blew me away, and you know, I understood it, but I just want to hear you describe it, you know, so that I can pick it up in my audio brain. That's the section where you somehow conceal a condom and you have it all set up, ready to go, and you sort of get it on the guy without the guy even knowing that it's on him. And that whole scene there, could you explain to me how you deal with a condom and a client?
This was passed on to me by another prostitute who taught me how to do it. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to invent this on my own. I would have kept having conversations like, well, you must use a condom or leave. But she was, you know, my mentor, Heather, she was about 8 years older than me and had been in the business for a good, I don't know, 10 or 12 years before I ever met her. So she knew that, you know, it was kind of sometimes a hard sell. Now, she'd been working probably longer than they had the whole AIDS scare. So at some point, it became very important to her to work with a condom, but there were still a lot of clients who just weren't on board for it. So it's not uncommon to have these kind of tricks. The street prostitutes actually hide the condom in their mouth, and they use their tongue to figure out which side is going down on the head of the penis. I've never developed that. Yeah, I know. It's a pretty advanced skill.
I guess.
Pretty advanced skill. For me, you know, when I was working indoors, so I really didn't need to be carrying it around in my mouth all day long, but I would just, about the time, you know, a client would show up, he'd give me an envelope of money, I'd say, okay, I'm going to go change into something more comfortable. I'd go into my walk-in closet, count the money real quick, make sure it's all there, because it's just, for some guys, they don't want to be reminded that they're paying for it by having you count it in front of them.
Yeah, I get you.
So you count it privately, and then while you're at it, you would be able to open up a condom and stick it in the palm of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you come back out, you know, in your lingerie, you've got one already in the palm of your hand, and they don't know it. And, you know, you can hug them, dance with them. There's all kinds of things you can do while that's still cupped in the palm of your hand. And then at the strategic moment, you're just going to drop it on the head of the penis. And I had always had long hair, so my long hair would be kind of obscuring the view, so they wouldn't necessarily see exactly what was going on. All they knew was that my mouth was inches from their cock, so that's all they could really think about. And then I just push it down with my mouth. So there was one young man in particular, he was a little younger than me, and he was scared to death. And he jumped up and said, don't do that without a condom. And then he looked down and realized I had put a condom on him. And he goes, how'd you do that? And
really.
So that's, you know, I prided myself in being able to put a condom on a man without him knowing. Because that's the kind of, that's the level of service that gets you repeat business.
Yes. Holy smokes. Well, in dealing with your men, in terms of the condom, I noticed you have, I think, a chapter with boundaries, you know. And I guess that's like one of your boundaries, which is that you use a condom with these guys. And I was just wondering, what other boundaries did you set with these guys when you, you know?
Oh my God, I have so many.
Yeah, this amazed me too. I'm thinking as I'm reading all these boundaries, I'm saying, now wait a minute. If I was, you know, getting it on with some woman, I wouldn't want all these boundaries in my way. And it's like, how on earth do you command your business at such a high salary and still have all these boundaries? But first, I'd like to get
this. This is going to be damn good, darling.
Yeah,
I know. It's going to be damn good. I don't suppose everybody could have pulled it off, but I certainly did. I loved what I was doing, and so I'm an and kind of person. See, most people think about either or. Either you like me or you don't. Either you're for us or you're against us, and I'm an and kind of person. So it's like I have healthy boundaries and I'm spontaneous and fun. So the people who came to see me over and over and over and over and over again, you know, I'm sure that they were annoyed with some of my health standards because I wouldn't take risks and I was very careful about my health. And, you know, if somebody tried to push it, I'd just go, yay, well, you know, if I wind up in the hospital, are you going to come see me? You know, probably not. So let's not even go there. And that would usually shut them up.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. But I, you know, I mean, if often said, well, you'd have to ask them why they kept coming back. Something was working for them. I think.
Yeah, but I'm just curious about what the boundary. I mean, for example, no anal sex and stuff like that.
Oh God, I mean, no, definitely not.
In other words, even with a condom, you wouldn't allow that?
No. I wouldn't allow a toy up there, a finger up there, nothing. Yeah, one of the things that I always used to say, when I go on these talk shows, they go, oh, the reason men come to see prostitutes is because the prostitute will do things their wife won't do. And I go, are you kidding me? I won't do half the shit their wives do. These wives, man, they're kicking out way too much for too little. You really want to know the secret, Paul? Let me tell you the secret. If I had just been catering to the low end of the spectrum, guys that could afford $200 or $300 an hour, it would have been more difficult. It wasn't because I had the Playboy Channel as a credit. I'd been on the Playboy Channel 3 times, and I had done some amateur porn. So when I was working the $300 an hour kind of guys, they would come in after having seen me on the Playboy Channel or seen me on TV, or they saw me in a video. And I think that was one of the reasons for them that it was worth it to go ahead and put up with the boundaries and all the long list of things that I would not do. But when I get to the high-end client, it's a totally different mentality. And again, you got to remember that most of these clients are looking to be dominated.
The CEO's type.
Right. So having an uppity, bitchy woman tell you what to do and have a bunch of no's is a big turn-on. It's a huge turn-on.
And now I understand. You gotta
be somebody really powerful with a lot of money to take that kind of crap. and here's the thing: if you actually, there's a great book out there. It's called The Book of Courtesans. It's written by a woman named Susan Griffith. Now, I've had some arguments with her because she doesn't think there's any modern day courtesans, and I go, yeah, well, I am one, so. You maybe need to reevaluate that. But she's chronicled courtesans of old, from the Renaissance period and various different other eras in history. And a very interesting pattern starts to emerge when you look at the really powerful, wealthy prostitutes. Almost every single one of them was uppity, difficult to get along with, very opinionated. As a matter of fact, there's a beautiful film, if you ever get a chance to rent it, it's called Dangerous Beauty, and it stars, God, I can't remember the name of the actress, but she plays Veronica Franco, who was a real-life courtesan from Renaissance Venice. And the thing about this woman was that her mother realized from an early age that her daughter was never going to make a good wife because she wasn't thoughtful enough. Yeah, she was feisty. She had a lot of fight in her. And she wanted to study, and she wanted to write, and she wanted to take up fencing, and she loved to argue with men publicly.
Uh-huh.
So she told her daughter, she says, you're going to have to be a courtesan because no man will marry you. And she became a very, very wealthy, prominent courtesan because of these attributes. So one of the things that always amazed me about high-level prostitution is that you actually get paid to be all the things that women are not allowed to be in the rest of life and in society in general.
Oh, really?
That's one of the reasons it appealed to me. Absolutely appealed to me. I could go to work and be who I really was and get worshipped and paid enormous sums of money for it. And, you know, I could have never done that if I had continued to work in corporate America.
Yeah, they're in the Hesse book called Siddhartha. Siddhartha runs into a courtesan who basically changes his life all around and teaches him how to be a man. And she's always perceived as at least his equal and at times a leader for his life and had given a direction to his life, you know.
Yeah.
Which is all I know about courtesans from fiction. But
well, the very first fictional story ever recorded in human history is the story of Gilgamesh. It's the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
And this is a story about a man who is running around wild in the woods, and he's copulating with the animals, and he crawls around on all fours. And the king says, this man needs to be civilized. And so he contacts a courtesan of the day, a sacred prostitute of the day, and she spends a week with this wild man, and she civilizes him with sex.
Okay.
Yeah, and so
I know about that book. I never read it.
Well, to see, if you go back far enough, these things are not considered silly or you know what I mean. They're real. That people actually felt that sex was sacred, that it was something that would make you more civilized. Now we have this attitude that sex is dirty and it makes you bad or demonic or evil or, you know, that it's wild and crazy and can't be trusted. But they used to actually believe, if you go back 6,000 plus years, actually believe that sex would bring you closer to the gods, that it was a doorway to the divine. And that it would civilize a animalistic person.
Animalistic men.
Yes. Men in particular in the story.
That's cool. That's good. You know, and when you're talking about the parameters or the boundaries that you would draw. I remember part in the book that I was also fascinated with. You said as you sort of started off drawing these boundaries, you were sort of apologetical and hesitant about saying no, but then you learned or evolved and you got to the point where you just more or less asserted it. No, that's just all it is, and just went on to the next topic, right? Something like that?
Oh, it really just had to do with the clients. The clients responded favorably. I mean, let's face it, I had worked for 7 years in corporate America, and although I didn't like having to be subservient and an ass kisser, anybody who's going to work in a... and trust me, I was not very good at it. But anybody who's going to... work in a corporate environment has to have that skill set or you won't be employed for very long. So had my clients not been reacting favorably, I'm sure that I would have, you know, there's no reason that I would have blossomed into this uppity assertive courtesan if they had not been encouraging of it. Because obviously I had certainly, you know, eaten more crow for less in the corporate environs, right?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, my first instinct was to think that I'm getting paid more, so I should probably put up with more. You know?
But it was just the opposite.
But it turned out to be the opposite, and this was a real mind blower for me at first. And you know what happened was I showed up for work one day, and some guy was like, "Okay," and I'm like, "Well, what do you want to do?" And he's like, "I don't know. That's up to you. I paid you. You figure it out." Oh my God! These guys expect me to know something. So I actually started taking classes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I took sacred prostitution classes from a woman named Cozy Fabian, and I took a fire breath orgasm class from a tantric teacher named Jawala, and I just, you know, started broadening my horizons so that I would have something to do when they came to see me.
Well, now you use that term in the book. I didn't quite get an understanding of fire breath orgasm.
Yes.
What kind of an orgasm is that?
It'll take the top of your head off. It is amazing. It's amazing. So I'm in this classroom and all these women are fully dressed, laying on the floor, doing tantric breathing. So you breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth, in through your nose, out through your mouth, in through your nose, out through your mouth. And I'm like, oh, come on, give me a break. This is bullshit. And they're squeezing their PC muscles. Now, that's the muscles that you squeeze when you really got to go to the bathroom real bad and you're trying not to. You know, mm-hmm. Number one, when you're afraid you're going to wet your pants when you're a little kid. That's the muscle we all hold on to. So I'm like, this is crazy. I can't believe this. We're all fully dressed. We're all laying on the floor making stupid noises and squeezing our PC muscles. So I'm about ready to go home. I'm looking around. Where did I leave my jacket? Where's my purse? And about the time that I thought, that's it, I'm out of here, all of a sudden, this ball of fire starts at the base of my spine, shoots out the top of my head, took my breath away. I thought I saw the face of God there for a minute. And I was like, oh, my God, this stuff's for real.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was my first introduction to Tantra.
Oh, and, okay.
I'm a big fan of Tantra now. I practice Tantra when I masturbate. I practice Tantra whenever I make love. And I have a lot of Tantric friends, you know, from around, mostly on the West Coast, up and down the coastline. So when I come into town... A lot of times we do Tantra together, which is really cool.
Let me ask you this about Tantra. This is another term, you know, I understand the spirituality and sex, but I don't really understand what somebody means when they say tantric sex, or, you know, what specifically are they talking about that's any different from just having regular old sex?
The biggest change would be that you actually focus on your breath.
The breathing type thing?
So a lot of people, when they're having sex, will hold their breath just before they get ready to have an orgasm, or they just pant, you know, they pant because they're working out. But it's not really like they are having a tantric experience. If you take up conscious breathing techniques and you learn how to circulate your breath from your partner to yourself, for instance, here's one tantric technique. You would actually be facing each other, maybe in the missionary position, maybe side to side. But you would be looking into each other's eyes. And when you breathe out, your partner would breathe your air in. When your partner breathes out, you would breathe your partner's air in. So you start circulating each other's breath, and you're breathing each other's breath. And if you're looking into each other's eyes and breathing each other's breath, then you've also aligned your heart chakras. So this would be the energy centers in the middle of your chest, so that your partner's heart chakra and your heart chakra are lined up with each other. And again, this stuff sounds really silly, but if you do it long enough, it can really lead to an intense orgasm, a sense that you and your partner are merging into one person. You can get a
wow.
Sense. Yeah, it's very powerful stuff. I did a tantric lovemaking with a friend of mine that we spread it over 3 days. And by the time I got home from that trip,
BBSRadio.com.
So, anyway, Paul, as I was trying to tell you, the fire breath orgasm started me on onto things. So, I'm thinking like 15 years at least. And I haven't always been real aggressive in learning Tantra because it's scary stuff. I mean, it really puts you in touch with intimacy, and it brings your spirituality and your sexuality so that they're intertwined. So it's not like you're over here having sex, you know, we're just going to fuck, right, which is kind of a nice thing. And then over here I go to church or, pray because a loved one died or something like that. But rather, it's very holistic. It's like your whole, your whole being. So, and it's pretty awesome stuff. But it took me, like I said, about 15 years to have Kundalini awakening. And that was so intense that for an entire month, I was having these spontaneous contractions that were so delicious that I didn't even want to have an orgasm. I didn't want to ruin it with an orgasm. So that's the best explanation I can offer you.
Oh man, does this come out of a? Is this strictly a sexual type of philosophy, or is it connected more with the religious type of philosophy?
Well, Tantra actually means to weave. It's a Sanskrit term that means to weave. And it's a way of life, which is usually about embracing all things, including the taboos. So sex is embraced for that reason. But here in the West, people have pretty much just imported the tantric approach to sex.
Okay, that explains that. Yeah, that's
amazing.
It's pretty
amazing. I mean, really, if you go back to the birthplace of Tantra, which is India, you'll see that there's all these sexual orgiastic pictures painted on the walls of the temples.
Aren't they the ones that gave us a Kama Sutra?
Yep, that too.
Yeah.
I think personally the Kama Sutra is overrated, but it's interesting.
Listen, you use another term. I wonder if you could, I'm sort of this old school sex guy, but another term you use that I'm not familiar with, which is, I think, chakras,
C-H-A-K-R-A-S.
Yeah, and that's
chakras are just energy centers. They're energy centers. And in my classes, a lot of times I'll ask people, just take, like the palm of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And touch somebody with it. And if you can especially put the palm of your hand in the middle of somebody's chest, that's a real power. You can feel it. It's like an electric connection. And then I ask people, just take your elbow and put it in the center of somebody's chest. And do you feel it's connected? Now, not everybody is, so sensitive that they're going to pick up on that energy difference right away, but most people do. Most people can go, no, I feel way more connected if I touch you with my hand than if I touch you with my elbow.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's because your elbow doesn't have a powerful chakra. There's an energy center in the palm of your hand. There's an energy center in the middle of your chest. There's energy centers. In various different places, up and down, mostly it kind of runs parallel to the spinal column. So you've got them in your gonads and the base of your spine and in your stomach area.
Mm-hmm.
And these are very powerful energy centers. So we learn to play with energy in Tantra. You learn to play with energy. So,
the energetic spots, I guess.
Let me give you, for instance, I used to go to lifestyle parties. This is a bunch of people getting in a room and having sex together. Now, there's plenty of energy going on there, but it's not tantric energy. So it's very exciting, and everybody's aroused, and certainly when you start having friction oriented sex, it can be pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
But now with Tantra, I could be in a room full of people who are doing conscious breathing techniques and moving that energy around. I could just be sitting there watching them doing nothing. And I was one time. I was over at a place called One Taste in San Francisco. The whole room was during these breathing, sexual breathing exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sitting there with a friend, and his finger brushed my ankle, and I almost had an orgasm.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, and I'm not actually that easy. I can't have orgasms that easy. But being in a room full of people who are playing with tantric energy is like a contact high. It's amazing. Amazing,
that
amazing,
amazing.
Amazing.
Wow. Let me ask you some other terms. When I read these things, and I have a sense of some of them, but for example, a lot of people talk about like diva. Diva But I'm never quite clear on the sexual. Is there a sexual connotation to diva too? I mean, a diva to me is a celebrated woman who is successful and known and a celebrity perhaps. But is there a sexual innuendo that they're great in sex? I don't know.
Well, not that I'm aware of. Diva mostly just means a woman who's treated like a goddess or a queen.
Ah, okay. That was another question I had, is how does a man treat a goddess? What is, especially a sex goddess like you, how would you expect to be treated as a sex or a goddess?
We're so high maintenance. and again, you know, it's my clients who taught me this stuff. So, the bar gets set pretty high because you have these amazing men come treat you in an amazing way. Now, it wasn't that way when I was in college, you know.
Yeah.
But here I was, you know, in my my 30s and 40s, experiencing admiration and devotion from men like I've never experienced in my whole life. So, for instance, I had one client who would come, he would book like 4 hours, and he would just come to kiss me from head to toe for 4 solid hours.
Wow.
He never, ever took his shorts off. He never wanted me to touch his penis. He never wanted to have an orgasm.
Wow.
He just wanted to adore me from head to toe for 4 solid hours. Now, a girl can get addicted to this stuff, especially when there's Ben Franklin's on the other side of it. So then Playboy shows up. Playboy's like, well, hey, we want to do something about your life. And so I go, well, great. I actually have a real-life client who would love to be on the Playboy channel with me. Let me put you in contact with him. So they interviewed him, and they got back to me, and they said, he's too good-looking.
Really?
I go, this is a documentary. You're doing my life. He is my client. He can't be too anything. He's my client. And they're like, oh, no, he's too good looking. He looks like Christopher Reeves. He did. He looked like Superman. He was a gorgeous, gorgeous young man with a fabulous body. And he says, well, we can't have him on because it'll intimidate our viewers. I'm like, oh, for God's sake. So that was strike one against them. The reality of how beautiful some of my clients were, they couldn't handle. So what they ended up doing is hiring a couple of milk toast male models. And these guys were just average looking. They weren't ugly, but they were just real average, and they didn't have phenomenal bodies or anything like that. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, this would be a mediocre day at work. So the first client,
VBSRadio.com.
Hey, Paul. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I thought it was fascinating. The guy that basically wanted to worship you by kissing you from your head down to your toes for 4 hours. That was amazing.
The thing that I was going to try to tell you about the Playboy channel was that they were upset because I said, okay, a half and half, you know. That's blowjob missionary style. In the trade, we call it a half and half. So with the first male model, I pantomimed that. I didn't actually do it, but I pantomimed it. And with the second one, I said, okay, what I want him to do is worship me. And they're like, what? What's worship? And I go, that means he's going to kiss me from head to toe very, you know, very reverentially. And they're like, is that all he does? And I'm going, that's what I make money doing. You are here to do a documentary, aren't you? I mean,
God's sakes.
And, oh, so the producer was just flabbergasted. He was flabbergasted, and I looked at him and I said, "It really bugs you to think I'd make a living this way, doesn't it?" But here's the funny thing. The male model, he was, I don't know, he might have been a couple years younger than me, but we were a similar age group. He had this like really jealous girlfriend in my kitchen.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She was like hanging out, just biting her nails. And he was having a great time. So he really loved the whole idea of the worship thing.
Well, now you have a term in your book too, body worship.
Yes.
Now, does that sort of like go both ways? I mean, you would worship the male body, or is it just strictly male worshiping
a
female
body? Well, it certainly can go both ways. But, you know, if you notice in my book, I wanted to share the things that I got paid to do, and I didn't get paid to worship men's bodies.
Okay.
You know, at home with my husband, I certainly worshipped his, but I never got paid to worship a man's body. So this was Sex Secrets of Escorts, not Sex Secrets of Successful Marriage.
Right.
So I wanted to teach people what escorts actually get paid to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know very many who would ever get paid to worship a man.
Wow. Of course, maybe we're talking, my mind's going back to the blue-collar type guys, you know, where, you know, they want certain things done to them or something
like
that.
Yeah, but that's not the worship thing, that's not even in that mentality. That would be like, yeah, I want you to suck my dick. That's not body worship.
Right,
that's
I got you.
The whole idea, it would be kind of like, why are you wasting so much time kissing my nipples, you know? I don't feel anything on my neck. Leave it alone. I mean, you know. Yeah, so it's kind of a hard sell. Believe me, I definitely introduced the whole idea of eroticizing the male body to lots of my clients who were, you know, they're kind of skittish about that. Guys are like, they don't want you to get close to their rectum because they think that'll make them gay. They don't want you to arouse their nipples because that'll make them gay. I mean, you know, it's just like a lot of taboos to try to teach men to actually enjoy sex. To the point where I start thinking, you know what? Men don't actually enjoy sex because they don't even know how. You know, they enjoy the idea of it, but is actually showing up for it. I had clients who were having more fun sneezing.
Well, I guess that's where performance anxiety comes about or something like that.
Well, sure, there's some of that. Definitely. Men are performers. Mm-hmm. You know, that was what was always such heartwarming. These guys would be bringing you all this money, but then they'd bring you, presents and flowers, and then they'd worship you and treat you like a queen, and you'd think, unbelievable, the trouble men will go to for a woman. You gotta love them. I mean, I started this job not really caring much for men, and it didn't take long for me to just feel so much compassion.
Oh, that's good.
And
you have a section in your book how a woman can seduce a man, right?
Big deal. Clients would come to me and say, I want you to seduce me, and I'd think, you're here, aren't you? I tell women don't think past that. You know, it's like we're a flower, and we try to be as smell as good and look as pretty as possible to get the bee to come over to us. and then you think your job is done. And these guys were asking for something else, and I was dumbfounded. I'm like, what the hell? I don't get it. I've already seduced you, or otherwise you wouldn't have walked through the door and given me this big wad of cash. So I had to figure it out, and I started going, oh, I get it. They actually want somebody to tell them how attractive they are, how irresistible they are, and to take their clothes off. And then to arouse their erogenous zones so that they don't have to be the one that initiates. And the reason that I don't call that body worship is because it still has a much faster pace to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually the guy is still very much interested in getting to the main event. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas when a man is body worshiping a woman, there is no main event. The main event is worshiping her body. And you don't work your way up to oral sex or intercourse. You just worship her body.
Uh-huh.
But when a man would hire me to seduce him, he wanted to eventually get to the oral sex and the intercourse, but he wanted the road to that destination to be initiated by me.
I got you. And
yeah.
That's what the, yeah, fascinating.
Yeah. I've got to tell you, to be able to take these men places they've never gone before in their whole life, I mean, it makes you want to tear up almost. And because a lot of times they would. I mean, it would
you
be
mean
such
emotionally.
It would be such an emotional trip for them to feel wanted. Can you, I don't have to tell you, I'm sure, I think a man's life is largely about having to balance the acceptance from the rejection, you know? Because you got to put yourself out there all the time. Because if you don't ask the woman, then probably nothing's going to happen.
Hey, it goes back to the old high school dance where I used to stand there and watch a girl and how many times she would reject these other guys. And that would sort of determine whether I wanted to take a chance in going up and asking her to dance and having her reject me, you know.
Part of
the male stuff.
God bless every one of you for being persistent. Because I just can't imagine. I just think that sounds so scary and disheartening, you know, to be getting no's. You know, it's like, well, how do you get up the courage to go and ask the next one?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think a lot of guys have to cope with that one way or another. And I frankly think some guys get a little twisted down the line. And as a result of, you know, what might be constant rejections, then who knows what path they take.
Yeah.
But it may not be a healthy path, you know.
Right.
I want to ask one more thing here. Or
okay.
More,
and believe it or not, we're going to have to wrap up the show.
Okay, good, good.
I hope you'll come back because this has been a ton of fun.
Oh, I sure will. I enjoy talking to you. You're full of energy, enthusiasm, and you're articulate on top of all this. So
well,
I really enjoy
you.
It.
Thank you, Paul. And you are just, you have the best laugh. I just love it.
Well, you got a great sense of humor.
So what was the other question?
Well, something about how you would meet these guys and you would be dressed kind of conservatively, or you'd dress to fit into sort of high society circles, you know, and then you get in the room with them and then you sort of at a certain time give them some raw sex or, you know what I mean? Something
uh-huh.
like that. The contrast. How did that work exactly? You took them by surprise, didn't you?
Oh, you just wear... you know, fishnet, well, not fishnets, you wear like really expensive stockings
mm-hmm.
with garters underneath, you know, G-string, push-up bra,
okay.
underneath a pinstripe suit.
Uh-huh. I can see the surprise there, yeah.
Oh, it creates a very delicious cognitive dissonance. Everybody wants somebody who looks like they belong in the corporate boardroom. But then, has all this naughty underwear on. and the other thing you can do, of course, is just go without underwear altogether. and
that's
keep
a pleasant
them with that.
Surprise.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
But usually what I did is I wore lipstick that was just a little more obvious than most of the women who were in professional jobs would wear. And then
uh-huh.
instead of wearing those really boring pumps that a lot of them wear, I would wear the high, maybe a 5-inch heel with an ankle strap. So
huh.
So you're framing this really corporate look with just a little more raw sex. Which they do quite a bit of that on television. Mm-hmm. The only difference is on television, they actually wear those real short mini skirts that nobody in their right mind wears to work. but all the high powered lawyers and detectives do, you know.
Yeah.
They got cleavage and legs up to here.
Yeah.
That's Hollywood for you. So even a real prostitute would not dress like that.
I got you. Let me ask one more quick question. This was in the back of my mind. Your book didn't address this, and I can assume you know, like the hookers out there in the streets and they got their pimp and everything like that. But you're going into situations, and I got the idea that you're handling this situation all by yourself because you don't have that guy behind you. But did you? I mean, how did you handle situations where you got into the room with a stranger and all of a sudden maybe things got a little weird or strange or went wrong?
Well, you just don't ever let that happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And which isn't to say that it doesn't. I one time in 12 years, I got into a bad situation with a bad guy, and I knew I shouldn't have gone. I just knew it. But there was something about him that was really seductive, because some other friends of mine who had been in the business for a long time and should have known better also wound up going to this guy's house. So, and once in 12 years is a lot better than twice in 4 years of college, I could tell you that.
Oh, boy.
Because, you know, I had two really bad dates in college. So when people say, oh, you're a dangerous job, I'm like, oh, no, college is dangerous.
Oh, wow.
I'd much rather take my chances being an escort than take my chances being a college co-ed, because they don't even prepare you for it, and nobody tells you that it's dangerous to go to college.
Wow.
Yeah. But mostly you just don't ever want to buy into the idea that I have to take this appointment, because that's where you go wrong.
Okay.
And famous last words that almost every woman who's ever wound up in a bad situation: he seemed like such a nice guy. It's like, no, we're not interested in whether or not he's a nice guy. Everybody's a nice guy. Even Ted Bundy was a nice guy, from what I hear.
Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus.
So, nice guy, doesn't matter. What matters is, how do you feel?
Your intuition cuts in somewhere.
How do you feel? This is a woman's job. It's all about women's intuition. I'm not saying that men don't also do this job, but most of them are gay. And, again, they would have, you know, that kind of intuition because they're cultivating the feminine attributes, which our society doesn't really value. So, I had to learn. I was very logical and academically oriented, and I had to learn how to have women's intuition because it wasn't coming naturally to me.
Oh, boy.
And I was taught by somebody who knew what she was doing. So, I didn't have a backup, and I didn't have a pimp, and I'm really glad, because I would not want to give my money away to somebody who probably, you know, I mean, from what I hear, I've never had a pimp, but I hear they can be pretty abusive people.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. 14
anyway,
years, quite a career.
It was very interesting, to say the least. So I probably better wrap this up before they kick us off the air here. Paul, and I hope you'll call in again.
Oh, I sure will.
And bring more questions. I love it when you put me on the spot.
Okay, well, I'm still not going to put you, I won't put you on the wrong spot, because I don't know how you'll react with me, but I'm glad I put you on the right spot anyway.
Oh, I'm a pussy cat. I only spank if you ask me to.
Oh.
And I only bite if you pay me.
Well.
Until next time, my dear, have a wonderful night.
Okay, thank you, Veronica, and good night to you, too.
Night-night.
Bye now.
Bye.
Veronica Monet offers help, healing, and hope in the form of private telephone sessions. Email veronica@sexwithoutshame.com to schedule an appointment, or visit www.sexwithoutshame.com to find out what Veronica can do for you.